Today we had 25 minutes of visitation. I thought that was wonderful. I enjoyed it. Hope you did too. If you didn't get a handout, there's some at the back. And it's entitled Resurrection. Last week we introduced our topic for today as we looked at the first part of the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John, and you might be turning there. I've given you some other verses on the handout that we'll refer to as we go through this discussion this morning. Do you believe in resurrection? Do you ever wonder what it's like? Can you blame the disciples for wondering about it? Last week we talked about the fact that Jesus, on three or four occasions, and probably more than are recorded in the Gospels, tried to explain to them what was about to happen. That he was going to be arrested and tried and crucified, and on the third day he would rise again. And what did Peter tell him? No, we can't let that happen to you. Can you remember when you were young? Some of us who are older have trouble going back that far. But we talk about the fact that teenagers sometimes, they don't even think about the possibility of dying. They're bulletproof. That's why they drive 100 miles an hour down city streets. Nothing's going to happen to me. But things do happen. And we all come, as we grow older, come to realize that we're not going to live forever here in this world, but that there is a life beyond this world. And we begin to treasure that, don't we? I don't know that any of us really understand it. Have you thought about it? I think you need to think about it. The Bible tells us a few things about it, not a whole lot, but some. We're not going to dwell on that so much this morning, but here is a Jewish rabbi teaching his disciples. And one of the central themes of his teaching is eternal life. And remember, these are teenagers mostly. His disciples don't get it. They don't understand it. And I'm not so sure that's surprising, because they don't think about dying. They don't think about needing it, really. And so they had trouble with that. Peter didn't believe that was going to happen. And if you drop down to the bottom reference on your handout today, we mentioned this last week. We didn't talk about Mark's version of this, but we probably should have. As they were coming down from the mountain, now they had been up on the mountain and had seen Jesus, what? Transfigured? What did that involve? How did Jesus' appearance, how was it different from before? He took on a glow, didn't he? His clothes were bright white, and he was blinding almost. And of course they were impressed with that. And they saw two people, who, with Jesus? Moses and Elijah. Were they dead? Had they died? Yeah, they had died. Moses had died about 1,500 years before, and Elijah maybe 800 or 900 years before. And here they were talking to Jesus about what were they talking about? Do you remember there's one of the Gospels tells you a little bit about the subject? They were talking with Jesus about his impending death and resurrection, weren't they? And of course, the apostles had no idea what to say about all of that. Now, as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen on the mountain until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. And they kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. They just weren't really sure, were they? And you don't blame them. They're young. They're not experienced. They haven't experienced a lot of death. How many people had they seen raised from the dead by Jesus? Well, that's the middle two sections of your handout today. They had seen two demonstrations of it at least. One of them was Jairus' daughter. Only three of them witnessed that. Who? Peter, James, and John. Peter, John, and James, I think, is the order that it's given here. Those three, and they probably told the rest of them about it afterwards. And then all of the disciples were with Jesus when they encountered the funeral procession coming out of the city of Nain, the widow's son. And Jesus did a surprising thing. He walked up to the men who were carrying the body in a casket, and what did he do? He touched it. Why is that surprising? You don't touch anything associated with a dead body. And why? Because the Jews considered that as a defiling act, wasn't it? You would have to undergo cleansing and purification after having touched the body. Those who carried the body would be unclean and unable to participate in Jewish sacrifices and the various religious rites until they had been cleansed. But he touched the body, he touched the casket, and they stopped. And then what did he do? Let's look at that. I see some blank faces. You've got it right in front of you. Yeah. When he went up, touched the coffin, and those who's carrying it stood still, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." Sounds like my mother coming in on a school morning and urging me to get started. The dead man sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. That's all that's said about it. But do you realize how remarkable that was and how the people of Nain responded? Were they amazed? Oh, you know they were. Well, were there any others raised from the dead? John said there are other things that happened that weren't recorded in the book, but maybe there were some more. Go back to the 11th chapter of Matthew, where John the Baptist had sent asking if Jesus was the one who was to come. And we talked about that in terms of context. You remember that he wasn't really doubting that Jesus was the Messiah. He was trying to find out if Jesus was going to rescue him from the prison. He had been placed in prison by Herod, and so he was concerned about getting out, and of course he wasn't going to get out. And so Jesus went through all of the prophecies in Isaiah about the things that the Messiah would do. And one of those, in the fifth verse of the 11th chapter of Matthew, is the dead are raised, the blind see. He talked about the gospel is preached, and all of the various things that the Messiah would do except setting the prisoners free. And by omitting that particular one, he told John that he's not going to get out of jail. And of course, it was shortly after that that John was beheaded. Getting John out of jail would have focused on Jesus the ire of the Roman government, no matter how he did it, and would have made things more difficult for Jesus in his ministry. okay, so today we have this, and last week as we looked at it, remember they went back across the river to where John the Baptist had been baptizing, and that's in the latter part of the 10th chapter. And a lot of people came. Here he stayed, and many people came to him. They said, though John never performed a miraculous sign, all that John said about this man was true. And in that place, many believed in Jesus. So the Jews on the other side of the Jordan, and this is up toward Galilee where this is, a little bit to the north, a couple of days' journey from Jerusalem. And so that's where they were. And they're going to, starting there, they're going to begin their last journey to Jerusalem, and that's the period of time that we're talking about in this class for this month and the month of February. And in the first part of the 11th chapter, we have the story about the messenger comes and tells. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, it says. They must have sent a messenger. They didn't have telephones or telegraph or any other way of doing it other than just to send somebody with a message. Lord, the one you love is sick. And Jesus, there must have been more to the message because Jesus knew who they were talking about. And of course, when he knew who it was that sent the message, he obviously knew. And when he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." And it's thought by some, and Burton Kaufman was one in his commentary, said he thought that was the message that was sent back to the women, to Mary and Martha, about the event. It will not end in death. And yet, from the timing of what we have here, it appears that he died about the time the messenger got there. So Jesus, of course, is knowing all along what's happening here. And he gets the word, but he knows that Lazarus had died. And it's going to take him a couple of days to get to Jerusalem. And he doesn't even start back for a couple of more days. So we'll see how that timing fits with what happens here. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was two more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there?" And Jesus answered. And then now this answer that he gives is kind of interesting too, because at first it's sort of enigmatic, isn't it? "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light." What does that have to do with the question that was asked of him? "Are we going back there? They were trying to kill you." See any connection there at all? Well, if you go back to the first chapter of John, you'll notice the discussion that John has in beginning verse 6 about John the Baptist. "He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world." Does Jesus walk by light? Well, obviously so. And what about his enemies? Do they walk by light? No, they walk in darkness, don't they? And what's he saying then? If we go and walk in the light, will we stumble? No mistake there. But the enemy who's walking in the night, what's going to happen to them? The ones who want to kill Jesus. You see, I think that has that implication in his answer here. We still have some time. And we're going back to Jerusalem, and I've told you about the things that are going to happen, but they're not going to happen right away, and they won't happen until God's ready for them to happen, see? But so the enemy can't do anything to us until God is ready. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." And now that message, of course, was interpreted the way most of us would. His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better." Did you ever have a high fever and a serious illness? And when you finally get over the crisis, then you can sleep and recover your strength. And that's the way they're viewing this. Then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe." Believe what? I think he's planning a program here to convince them about resurrection, isn't he? They're going to witness one, and that's not the only reason why he does this, but that may be a byproduct of it. These young men don't understand death and resurrection, and he's going to demonstrate something to them. "For your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe." But let's go to him. So they go. Now, Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of his disciples in verse 16 in the 11th chapter, "Let us go also that we may die with him." What's his optimistic view of this trip? He's totally pessimistic about it. We go back there, he's already told us he's going to get killed. We might as well go back and get killed too. And so let's go. He was committed. That's right. And we kind of make fun of him for a statement like that, but actually it is a statement of commitment. So, in verse 17, on his arrival. Now, John doesn't record that trip back from Bethany beyond the Jordan to Bethany next. There's two cities named Bethany. One, the Bethany beyond the Jordan was called Bethabara also in the Bible. The Bethany next to Jerusalem is just 2 miles away, where Mary and Martha and Lazarus had lived, is just a short distance on to Jerusalem. So it takes a couple of days to go from over there to here. And that trip is not recorded by John, but it is by the other Gospels. Several things happened along the way. They passed through Jericho. What happened at Jericho? Well, there was a blind man named Bartimaeus, who was healed and made to see, who followed Jesus on toward Jerusalem. Something else happened there. He met a man who had been a tax collector, a publican. What was his name? Zacchaeus, that's right. And the one who climbed the sycamore tree, remember that story? That happened coming out of Jericho as well on the trip up. And so there's a couple of days here John doesn't record, but the others do. And while we're talking about that, John's the only one that records what we're going to see in the latter part of the 11th chapter of John. Why don't the Matthew, Mark, and Luke record the raising of Lazarus? Some people have said, well, it's only in one of them. It probably isn't true. There are some reasons that you can think of. The one that I think is probable, but we can't prove it. There are just some conjectures here. Suppose after Lazarus was raised, we're going to see later on that his life was threatened by the authorities, because his resurrection was a tremendous sign. And so maybe he lived a while. And when Matthew, Mark, and Luke were writing their Gospels, he was still alive. And they didn't want to call attention to him. But that when John wrote the last of the four Gospels, he had already died. And so now he's free to talk about him. That's a possible reason why it only occurs in one of the Gospels. I don't know why. But anyway, the other Gospels talk about this return trip in more detail. John jumps all the way up to his arrival. Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. if excuse me, if, as we said, Lazarus died about the time the messenger got to Jesus, remember it takes about 2 days to come and go, then 2 more days for Jesus waiting and then 2 days to come back would be the 4 days that they're talking about here. Some scholars point out that the Jews had a belief about death. I don't know if this has anything to do with it or not, but they believed that at death, the spirit sort of hung around for a few days, 2 or 3 days, to see if it would be needed again. And when decay began to set in, then it gave up and left. And so by the 4th day, the spirit would definitely be gone. I don't know what led them to believe that, and certainly not anything revealed in the scriptures about it. But anyway, the 4 days may have persuaded some people more than someone who'd only been dead a few hours, you see. Because the people, the critics of Jesus might claim that on occasions to explain away a resurrection, a raising from the dead. So here we have 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. There you have it in verse 18. And many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. Some have criticized Jesus for letting Lazarus die. And they're going to criticize him too. The people looking at this, it's sort of an implied criticism. If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. But did Jesus have to be there to heal him? They didn't realize, I guess many of them didn't realize, that he could have healed him at long distance. I mean, it's not a matter of him touching. And we have some examples of that. You might remember the centurion's servant. The centurion sent to him to heal his servant whom he loved. And Jesus agreed to go, but the centurion said, "No, you don't have to come to my house. I'm not worthy." What? "Just say the word, and my servant will be healed." And was Jesus impressed with that? He was. He said, "Well, I haven't seen that kind of faith in anybody here among the Jews. And here's a centurion." He said, "Well, I say to a man, go, and he goes. And I say, come, and he comes. And do this or do that. And they all obey me, and you're certainly a rabbi with authority, so you can do that." Well, he could have healed him from Bethany beyond the Jordan. Why did he put Mary and Martha through this? We've all been there, haven't we? I dare say everyone in this room has had someone they love die and know the sorrow that they're going through. And have you ever had that thought? Why is God doing this to me? Why did God let that happen? Someone that you pray for weeks, they have cancer or pneumonia or something, or even growing old, and they die. And you say, "Well, I've asked that they not die, but God, why have you let them die? Why did Jesus let Lazarus die?" And there's some bitter memories associated with death on the part of many people. And so maybe Jesus was even reluctant to allow this. Maybe he picked very carefully who would be the one that he would demonstrate resurrection with. But is it fair to put Mary and Martha through that? What's going to happen? Is anybody going to benefit from this? There are going to be dozens, if not hundreds, who believe after seeing this. And certainly it's to the great benefit of his disciples, his close class of people that he's teaching to be apostles. Why do we benefit also? Of course, everybody who ever reads this chapter benefits. That's what you're saying, yes. And so we all benefit from this description of what happened. And we pass through times of sorrow in our lives, don't we? And we don't know why. I enjoyed reading a short article in the newspaper. I think it was in the religion section last Saturday. A woman saying about funerals, did you read that? She said her mother told her, don't worry about it, just go to the funeral. And she didn't understand why. But she went, and she found that after she was there, that some people she hadn't seen in a while saw her there, and they were greatly encouraged by her presence. That's true, isn't it? That we never know what influence we're going to have on other people when we show up at an occasion like this, because people are struggling. They feel alone. They feel nobody cares. And so that's why we go. And I think that was a correct evaluation of it. It's not a pleasant thing, but go, because some people will benefit from your presence. Well, Jesus is doing this to Mary and Martha for a reason, of course, and afterwards they'll understand it. But for the moment, it seems difficult. Very difficult. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Incidentally, Mary and Martha probably live in one home, and Lazarus probably had a separate house somewhere in this same village. They probably didn't all live together in the same house. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And all the ifs connected with someone's death. We'd just gotten... They were talking about that the other day in the case of a house fire. If I could have just gotten in there, the lady said, if I'd just come by and seen the smoke 15 minutes earlier, we could have rescued the people that were killed. If, it happens, doesn't it? There are lots of ifs connected with someone dying. And we worry about that. Could I have done it differently? Could I have taken a different road? Could I have gone at a different time? And it would have all been different. Well, maybe, maybe not. But she says, Martha says, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. What do you suppose she's thinking there? Does she have a hint of a possibility that he might raise Lazarus? Or is she thinking of something else? We may never know. Yeah. But even now, God will give you whatever you ask. She has great confidence in Jesus' ability, whatever he decides to do with this situation. Her hope. Right. Fear and hope, we live in between those, don't we, all the time. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Now, he has one thing in mind, but Martha has something else here, doesn't she? She answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She's heard Jesus talk about that, hadn't she? She remembers what Jesus has said about this subject, and she's encouraged by that. She just hardly can hope that he's going to rise now, but at least he will rise at the last day. Jesus said to her, and I have put this verse at the top of up here, the second one in your handout. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? What does Jesus mean when he says, I am the resurrection and the life? I thought resurrection was an action, isn't it? Calling someone back from the dead. How is Jesus the resurrection? Pardon me? He's a proof of resurrection? What else you think he might mean?
He said on other occasions that the Father gives life, and he's made that resonant within the Son. So I have the ability
to give life. What other things did Jesus say he was? I am what? The way, the truth, the life. I am the good shepherd. What other I ams? I am the great physician. Living water. I am the bread of life. See, there's a group of these things that we look at this one maybe a little bit in isolation, but they all are similar in their meaning. I think that Jesus is the embodiment. And then that's kind of what we were saying here, isn't he? Of resurrection. And so he is the firstborn from the dead, says over in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. So he is an embodiment of this. And so he has the ability to give life. I am the resurrection and the life. Even though he dies, says, he who believes in me will live. So even though some of us, some of our family, some of our friends, some of the past, and all of the people of the past have died, they will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. And you know, that's kind of like over in Thessalonians, where Paul talks about those who were concerned that some had died. And he talked about in the resurrection, those who have died, what will happen to them? They'll be resurrected first, and then we'll all be caught up together with them in the air. Remember that? And so he's talking about the fact that physical death is trivial. That's hard for us to believe. But even though you die, you will live and then never die. Yes, Lord, she told him, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. What a marvelous confession she makes. It's equal in all respects to that Peter made, isn't it? I believe that you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here and is asking for you. Did Jesus ask for her? Well, it isn't recorded, but obviously he did. Where's Mary? And so Martha goes to get Mary. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And when the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. And when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, had Mary and Martha been talking about this, do you suppose? Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. They had discussed this at length, hadn't they? If. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her were also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Jesus' compassion. This has been analyzed to extreme extents, I suppose, trying to figure out why Jesus wept, why he was troubled. He was deeply moved in spirit. We're not really sure how to evaluate that, are we? Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. Now, who are these Jews? They came from where? They had come from Jerusalem. Mary and Martha were well known. They had a lot of friends, apparently, and there was a pretty good-sized group of people that had come to comfort them. But some of them said, some of the Jews, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? What blind man? Well, back in the 9th chapter of John, we see the story of the man born blind who was healed by Jesus. And apparently that's the one they're talking about. That's who John is talking about. And they were reluctant to believe that he'd even done it. Now they say, well, okay, we'll admit that he opened the eyes of the blind, but he could have kept this man from dying, Lazarus. Notice they don't have any hope of him doing anything about that. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. When Jesus was resurrected, did they have to take away the stone? No, they didn't, did they? They took away the stone, though. Why? Who took away the stone, as a matter of fact? Angels did it. Why? To let Jesus out? Let Peter and John and Mary and them go in. Sure. So, we have a similar situation here. Take away the stone. But Martha objects, doesn't she? But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there's a bad odor. The Greek is, by this time he stinks. For he has been there 4 days. Decay has set in. So no doubt about the fact that he's dead. There's not anybody going to claim that he's still alive and that Jesus is just healing him. Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? When did he tell her that? Back in verse 4, that God's Son, for it is for God's glory so that God's Son may be glorified through it. That was the message sent back, and that's why there's the belief that the messenger sent that word back to Mary and Martha. So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked up and said, here's his prayer. Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When did Jesus pray and God had already heard him? That tells you that Jesus is in contact with God all the time, isn't he? He's just saying it out loud now for the benefit of whom? Those in earshot. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Then Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Burton Kaufman said there was a famous country preacher who was talking about these verses and said if he had just said, come out, every tomb in the world would have opened. And the dead come out. He had to restrict it to Lazarus, didn't he? He has that ability, and that's said in some of his sayings, that in the end that the Son of Man will give a shout and the dead in Christ will rise. This is a specific occasion to demonstrate that that's the case. Now I ask you, did Lazarus come forth the way he was, or did he come out in a new body? Like the resurrection as it ultimately will be. We don't know, Paul says over in his writings, we don't know how we will be when we're resurrected. We don't know what kind of a body we'll have. We know that when we're raised, we'll be like him. We'll be like Jesus. So was this a resurrection like the final resurrection, or was this one like the son of the widow of Nain, where he just sat up and think Lazarus came back the way he was, as if he had been healed and hadn't died. Is that your impression? Or he may have had a different attitude. That would be hard to evaluate, wouldn't it? Imagine if it had happened to you. So, the assumption is he came back the way he was. They woke up, they're just like they were. Well, almost like they were. Hopefully rested. But assuming that's the case, do we really know that? Now, when Jesus was resurrected, we know that he somehow had a little bit of a different appearance. People could recognize him, but not right away. Remember that? We'll talk about that maybe some in February when we get to that point. There's a lesson about the resurrection. But what tells you that almost 100% certainty Lazarus was raised the way he was before? Still bound.
Well, also a little bit later, I don't know if this is what you're going on, but the Jews wanted to kill him.
That's right.
So he must have resumed his
former identity, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Who is the firstborn from the dead? Christ. And I think that any of the resurrections before them are a little different in some respects. The resurrections after Jesus was resurrected, and there are some, over in Matthew 27 and 5, I think there's I don't remember what verse it is. But to the effect that after Jesus was resurrected, many of the saints of the Jews came out of the tomb. They were resurrected too. It's a very enigmatic verse, but it says they appeared after his resurrection. They appeared to many people in Jerusalem. Pardon me? Yeah, and maybe she was resurrected differently too. I don't know, but that may not be all cases, but presumably because this was before Jesus' resurrection, likely he came back the way he was. Well, let's see what effect this had. Yeah, we presume he died again. We aren't told. Yeah. Now, therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. That's verse 45. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Are they unbelievers? Or are they hoping to convince the Pharisees that Jesus is who he says he is? If you give them the benefit of the doubt, you say, well, these people need to know that this really is the Messiah, and so we'll go tell them. I think that may be the case. But, yeah, some of them went to see the Pharisees. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they ask? Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. Do they deny his raising Lazarus? No, can't hardly do that, can you? If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. What's their place? Their rulers. And their nation? The Jewish nation was struggling to stay intact under the Roman rule, weren't they? Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. And he did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. Isn't that remarkable? He's a prophet. He's an enemy. But what he says is true. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. And if you go on down into the 12th chapter, you'll find out that they were also plotting. Verse 10, chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. Most remarkable. And so all of these reasons, this demonstration was an essential one in the following that he had. Now on the day of Pentecost, when Peter preaches and explains all of this as it applies to Jesus, the response was overwhelming, wasn't it? Thousands. And so these people know this. Next week, we're going to look at the ensuing events as Jesus prepares to go into Jerusalem. And he's in control of everything that happens to him. When I was a child, I used to read this and I would think to myself, maybe it'll turn out different this time. Jesus is surely smart enough to know what's going to happen. He could escape. He doesn't want to escape. And that's clear to us, I think, and we'll look at that in detail as we go along. Notice in your handout, the very first verse that I gave you up there is one from Daniel. It was mentioned last week. Someone mentioned it. One of the clearest prophecies in the Old Testament about resurrection. Okay, read the scripture that I gave you on your schedule here, and we'll start there next week. Thank you very much.